Hey listeners, we've got a very special and extra long episode for you today. In our zeal to discuss the story of Yosef, we blessedly skipped summarizing chapter 38. Jazz and I came back later to record a short episode on that chapter specifically, and if you like wearying and problematic tales about sex or marriage, you can catch that episode on our
Patreon.
Enjoy the show.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to Kosher Queers, a podcast with at least two Jews and generally more than three opinions. Each week we bring you queer takes on Torah. They're Jazz.
And she's Lulav.
And he's Dika. And today we're going to talk about Vayeshev.
This week, Lulav's back with us. So listeners, if you missed her terribly last week and were bored by me and my family, I guess. One, rude. We are terrific. And two, rejoice, for she has returned.
Yay.
But if you're like, Jazz, I like having new people, never fear. We have another guest joining us this week, and I'm real excited about it. So, Dika graduated from Yale with a BA in philosophy, so unlike either of your usual hosts, he's got an actual academic grounding for text study. And, as one does with a BA in philosophy, Dika has been teaching for the last 12 years. He's taught Latin, speech and debate, and a couple other subjects in New York City public schools. He's very, very good at it. Think national championships and award for teaching. I'll link to an article about him in the show notes. But I will say I'm a little salty about that article because it's one of those articles where the reporter sidesteps gender by just including no pronouns whatsoever, which I was a journalist. That's not great. But having recently escaped the charter school world, Dika now teaches Jewish children about Judaism and is my coworker. He's also a queer, transmasculine, Irish-Italian New Yorker who is on this particular episode for a very special reason. Dika, want to tell the listeners what's happening this week?
Sure. So even though I'm 34 years old, I am making my bar mitzvah this week. I converted to Judaism about 5 years ago, so I missed the ritual that most 13-year-old children get to have. Luckily, I still look like I'm a 13-year-old child, so, aww, you know, I have that covered. But yeah, so I will be making my bar mitzvah in the same room where I got married 6 years ago.
Bless.
Yeah.
It's very exciting. And on this parsha, right? On parsha, the
Vayeshev. Yep.
Thanks. We keep calling it just the, you know, all of the episodes that start with a V, like a bunch of them in a row. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah.
Also, I'm looking at a picture of you and you look like at least a 16-year-old boy. Come on.
I mean, okay, fine. I still am asked all the time what grade I am in when I'm at high school debate tournaments. Like,
no!
To this day.
Didn't you say that when you were at your literal wedding, somebody...
Carded me. The bartender, yes.
Okay.
Yes, that happened. They carded me and my partner, because both of us will perpetually look like children, apparently. But, you know, that's what you get for being trans or non-binary or whatever.
Yeah. And you said you got to choose to do this one?
Yeah, so there's a couple of real perks that have to do with having an adult bar mitzvah. One being, it's so much easier to plan a party. No social anxiety there. It's just all my friends having bagels. It's going to be great. And two being, I get to pick what week I wanted to do it and what story I wanted it to be on. And, I mean, I knew it was going to be the book of Genesis, because that to me is just like where all the fun is in the Torah. Like, everything else is like, it's okay, but like Genesis is just, you can't beat it. Like, there's so much drama, there's so much plot, there's so many characters. It's just this amazing story. And then within the book of Genesis, Joseph's story I think is important because it resolves everything that came before it and then sets up everything that comes after it. You know, it closes out the book of Genesis. It sets you up in Exodus. It's just like a really pivotal story. And that's the one I wanted to do. So that's what I'm doing.
That's really cool. Are you ready for me to mangle your bar mitzvah portion?
I can't wait. Go for it.
Lulav, I am timing you. How long am I timing you for?
I would say no longer than 60.
Okay.
What do you think?
I saw a snippet of that summary, right? Let's say 60. That seems fine.
Okay.
Ready?
I am ready.
Go.
Yaakov's favorite child is Yosef, who tells his self-aggrandizing dreams to his brothers for some reason. The brothers plot to kill him. The Reuven is in favor of just chucking him in a pit. They tear his amazing technicolor dream coat to prove he's dead, and Yehuda sells him into slavery to passersby. Yaakov is very sad, and Yosef is in Egypt now. Yehuda goes on to have children and to die for various reasons, including masturbation. He accidentally does a sex with his daughter-in-law, which means his third surviving son can't be her third husband, to her benefit. Yosef is doing well as an Egyptian house slave, but gets propositioned by his master's wife, and she frames him for rape when he refuses her. He is thrown in the Pharaoh's prison as a result, but becomes the prison capo because he's so personable and responsible. Some prisoners have dreams, which Yosef interprets. Even though the prophetic interpretations come true, the surviving prisoner doesn't remember Yosef positively after being released.
That was so good! That was so perfectly timed.
Thank you. That one I didn't time. I wrote it immediately before you called me.
There's a lot happening here.
There is. Jazz, do you want to take us through that step by step?
Yeah, sure. Okay, we'll start at the beginning. Interestingly named, we have a thing about how this is the family history of Jacob. And when Joseph was 17 years old, this story takes place. So I actually do have a question for either of you, which is, do you have a thought as to why this is framed as the family history of Jacob, who's actually not very much in it?
Yeah, so I can talk to that a little. I want to point out also in that just those first couple of lines, you see something cool happen where it says that it's a family history of Jacob. Then it says, so this is the line of Jacob, Joseph, and he tended the sheep with his brothers. And, you know, there's a couple things going on. Like, well, one, what do you mean this is the line of Jacob, Joseph? What about the 10 sons that were older than Joseph, right? And doesn't the family history mean, like, all of them? Like, how could you say the line of Jacob is just this one kid? Mm-hmm. And then another thing that I did not come up with, but that a commentator that I read came up with, was I thought was a good point, is that the way that it's written in these, even in these first, like, two verses, you find out that Joseph is standing in between Jacob and his brothers, right? Because it says Jacob, then it says Joseph, and then it says his brothers, which really is what this portion is all about, because Joseph's brothers miss their father, and they miss their father's love, and you might even argue they miss, like, the birthright, you know, like, they're kind of frustrated that Joseph gets this special treatment, and, you know, just because he's Rachel's first son doesn't mean he's Jacob's first son.
Yeah.
And that's really, like, the heart of the whole portion right there, and it's like, you get at it right in those first two verses.
Ooh.
Having favorites kind of sucks, is my opinion on that.
So the next bit that happens, right, is that we get introduced to the concrete evidence of that, the coat of many colors, and how it prompts his brothers to be angry at him. And
so, just side note for a second.
Okay.
Coat of many colors, right? Not what the Hebrew says.
Right.
What's the Hebrew say?
If you look it up in the BBB, it will say, like, footnote, Hebrew uncertain.
Ooh.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah.
We know it is a piece of clothing because the brothers strip it from him later, but we don't actually know what it is. And I think it's, like, cool that it's taken on this life of its own. It's like a technicolor dream coat. Like, I don't know. What is it? It's just, like, this special second coat. So one thing, I think Rashi says this, somebody's comment on this is like, what matters is not that it was many colors. What matters is that it's a second coat, mm-hmm. because all of the brothers had one coat, like symbolically, right? Like, you know, imagine that, like, just being a member of this family means that, like, you're all wearing, like, one shirt. But then whoever is the Bechor, or the firstborn son, according to, like, the laws that come up, I think later in Deuteronomy or somewhere, the Bechor gets, like, a second portion, right? That's, like, the traditional way. And I know we never do things traditionally with firstborn sons in Genesis, which is why I like this so much. But that's traditional. But the fact that he gets a second portion, whether it's got many colors or not, doesn't really matter. What matters is that he gets a second portion, which is why it's so cool that when the brothers strip it away from him later, that's what they're trying to strip away. Like...
Oh, yeah.
Like, they're stripping away the thing that was unfair, the thing that, like, he got that he actually shouldn't have had, in their opinion.
And it makes a lot of sense that it says, and he had made him a long robe with sleeves, and goes directly from there to, but when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they mm-hmm. hated him.
Right.
So that makes sense.
Yeah, because otherwise you're like, why are you hating on the sleeves? Like, what's, like, what's going on here? It can't be that bad of a coat. I'm sure it's fine.
Thanks for that insight.
Yeah, sure.
Do we have any idea of why then it takes on this implication of many colors over time?
I don't know, because the 70s, they had Technicolor. I don't know.
I think part of that is there's a lot about dreaming in Yosef's story. Mm. So, like, dreams are technicolor, especially in the 70s.
There's a person who I respect very much who has talked about this Torah portion in particular, and Joseph as being just the gayest of our ancestors.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Which may be part of why I picked this. It's just a...
You know. Good.
So anyway, then he dreams and tells
Wait, before he dreams, though.
Okay.
You gotta read the part where it goes, and he brings bad reports of his brother to his father. You can't skip over that.
He's snitching.
Yeah, like, this is... Yeah, like, what's the deal, Joseph? Like, you already are getting the special treatment from your dad, and then you're gonna rub it in by, like, talking trash about your brothers?
That's not the order things go in, right? First he brings bad reports, and then he gets a special coat.
Which is even more problematic, right? Because, like, I mean, I think the special coat has to do with the fact that he's Rachel's son, right? Because the special treatment has to do with the fact that he's Rachel's son. Rachel was the loved wife, and so Jacob's giving him the special treatment.
Right.
But if that's not what it is, and it's like he's just snitching on his brothers to get special treatment, then it's like he's even more in a hole, which he ends up in later, literally. But, you know, like, what are you doing, Joseph? I think we can't skip that. I think we have to, like, name that he does that.
Right, okay. So Joseph brings bad reports to his father, and his father favors him, and when his brothers see both of this, they hate him and cannot speak to him, cannot speak well to him.
Fun play on words here. If you look at the Hebrew where it says, and they hated him even more, you know how they say that in Hebrew?
Mm. No.
They say that they added on the hate. You know how you say add in Hebrew? Yosef.
Oh, okay.
So
good.
Yosef means like to add or like to add on to. You see his name actually being used throughout the parsha a couple times, because every time like the brothers hated him more or they added to their hate of him, it's just this like fun pun that's happening. But anyway.
That's so good.
Torah just loves its puns.
I know.
Okay, now you can talk about dreams, Chad.
Let's talk about dreams.
Now we can talk about dreams. He dreams and then tells his brothers about it. He insists that they hear it. And the thing he says is, we're all out in the field and working together. And then the sheaf of wheat that I tied up stands up straight. And the sheaves of wheat that you tied up then, like, made a parade around it and bowed down.
Which, literally, dude, you don't need to say this. Keep your dreams where you're really cool to yourself, please.
So I have two small questions about this dream.
Two?
There are bigger questions, but first, he tells this to them, and they do not like it. And then he tells them another dream, where he says, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowed down to me. And he tells this one to his brothers and to his father. And this time, his father is the one that tells him off for it. So my first question is to follow up on Lulav's point. Why does he tell it to them?
Mm-hmm.
Because he's a little punk?
Yeah, no, that's my interpretation. This is like a very personal parsha to me.
Why?
Suddenly, because, I don't know, I kind of had this dynamic with my sister, and it was not fun. And so I very much empathize with the brothers here.
Was your sister having dreams that you were bowing to her?
Not quite like that, but just the general thing of, like, everything she says, she thinks she's so cool about that. Sorry to trash my sister on this podcast, but...
Sorry, Lula, sister. Are you older or younger?
Older. So even more a thing.
Interesting. Little siblings looking for attention.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's just, like, an expectation that that self-aggrandizement will be rewarded the way that literally everything else is for this younger child is my feel on that. Also, let me know if you need me to tone down the trauma.
My second question about the dream is, why does he tell the first one to his brothers and the second one to his brother and father?
Well, the second one involves his father, right? Because there's a sun and a moon in the second one and the stars. And the first one is just like the wheat that the brothers are holding, right?
Right. The father definitely thinks that this one includes...
Yeah, which is why the father gets so mad, according to some thinkers, because at this point, it's understood that Rachel's already dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Jacob says, what do you mean that your mother and I should bow to you? He's like, now you're just rubbing salt in the wound. Like, how dare you say that it's going to come to pass that your mom and I will be able to bow to you? You know that your mom is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So that's the way that some interpreters have read that, and so maybe that's why he tells him, because he's in it.
Yeah, there's a darkness to, shall we indeed come, I and your mother and your brothers.
Right.
That's rough. I agree with that. But like the first thing I think is like, oh, my brothers didn't think this was cool. So now I got to tell dad.
Yeah. It's strange, though, because it seems like in all other conversations that are happening, the one that Joseph would go to first would be his dad, right? Because right? He and his brothers can't speak peacefully to each other. So I don't know. I think it is an interesting question, Jazz, and I'm not sure why.
Yeah.
Well, okay, and so then they do go out and they're tending the flock together.
Brothers or brothers and Joseph?
The brothers are tending the flock, mm-hmm. and their father sends Joseph out to join them.
Yeah, we got to talk about that.
I want to hear a thing, and then I have a question about a small textual thing.
So the real question is here, like, Jacob, what are you thinking? You love your son. You know that your other sons hate this son. You know that they're especially pissed off because he just told them all these dreams he's been having. And then you're going to send him, of all places, to Shechem. Do you know what happened in Shechem, like, two parshas ago?
Ooh, which one was this?
Your daughter was raped. That happened in Shechem by a guy named Shechem. And then your other sons went and killed everyone in Shechem out of revenge. Like, Shechem is not a place where good things happen for your family, right? Like, you know that. That is a source of trauma and pain. And now you're going to send your beloved little boy to go meet his brothers there. Like, are you out of your mind? So there's a couple of interpretations I've heard. Like, two of them I'll share briefly. One is that Jacob is a little full of himself because, you know, we know that Jacob's a little full of himself. He thinks that he's the ultimate trickster, right? That's, you know, he stole the birthright and he's the one that can deceive everybody else. He thinks that he's in charge, even though he's not. Jacob decides to, like, play his own test here, his own, like, Akedah. Right, to repeat what his grandfather did when Abraham did this to Isaac. And he's like, well, you know, this is maybe the moment where I'm going to know just how loyal are you to me, Joseph, because I know that you're afraid of your brothers right now. And if I ask you to go to them right now, will you listen to me, right? Even though you're afraid of your brothers. And like, there's a textual echo of that in the way Joseph responds to him when Joseph says Hineni here. Right. Every time we see Hineni, it's like ding, 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 Akedah alert, right? Joseph knows what this is too, under this interpretation, and he says yes. So that's like one possibility what's going on. Another possibility what's going on, which is my personal favorite, has to do with the little interlude that comes next. Before Joseph gets to his brothers, he sees random guy wandering in the fields, and he says, hey, random guy, you see my brothers? And random guy's, oh no, they've gone from here. They're over in Dothan now. And Joseph goes, okay, cool, thanks. And he goes to Dothan. All right. So the interpretation I like the most about this trial that Jacob is sending him on is that whether he intended it to be an Akedah or not, God sends this messenger. And this messenger is actually an angel. Shocker, I know. Angels in the book of Genesis. And the angel knows something Jacob maybe also knew, right? Maybe Jacob knew the brothers weren't in Shechem. Maybe Jacob knew that they were in Dothan. He knew, you know, he knew that they were going to start the morning in Shechem, then they were going to go there for lunch. And Jacob in his head is like, okay, well, Joseph's going to show up there. That proves to me that, you know, he's loyal and he does what I say him to do, okay? But he's in no danger because the brothers aren't going to be there by the time he gets there. He's going to come back home. The field's going to be empty.
Ah.
He's not expecting a messenger of God to get in the way and to redirect the course of the family's history now by telling Joseph, nah, like, your brothers are over there. Go get them. And the other thing that's interesting that's like a textual piece here is the angel says to him, your brothers have gone from here. And again, I think it's Rashi, interprets the I think it's Zeh, their brothers have gone from this. Vayomer ha'ish nasu mizeh. There we go. From this. Rashi reads this as the angel's not just saying to Joseph, the brothers have left Shechem. The angel's giving him a warning, and the angel's saying, look, your brothers have left brotherhood. And next time you see them, they're going to betray you, and this is what's coming. Right? Your brothers don't consider you a brother anymore.
And that's all in the subtext, right?
That's right. It's not, he doesn't say that outright, but when he says mizeh, they've gone from here, that's how Rashi reads that here, that they've gone from.
Okay.
So we know that Joseph he's in danger. This is a scary movie, the scary music that's starting in the movie. You know, like, something dramatic's about to happen. Anyway, so what's your textual question?
My textual question is, both of you know, I think that names are a thing that is of interest to me. And
shocking,
I know, for all of us here. The text switches the name it's using for their father figure at this point. When Abraham changes his name, the text just switches over and calls him Abraham reliably from there on out, in the way that the text does not switch from Yaakov to Yisrael. But in the middle of this story, it does switch over. At the beginning, we hear that, like, this is the family history of Yaakov. And when he sends Joseph out, we're back to Israel again as a name.
And later, we'll see Jacob.
So why the name changes back and forth? What do you think?
Lula, do you have any thoughts on this?
Not off the top of my head. Do you have any, Dika?
So, I can try it. I have tried to kind of sort it and figure out, can I find the pattern? And I don't think I found it yet. And I haven't read anyone that's, like, laid it out, like, exactly yet. But if I had to guess, I think it's because in the story of Joseph, we are transitioning from an Abraham and Isaac and Jacob relationship between man and the divine, between people and God, that was very absolute, to a relationship between Joseph, Jacob's son, and God that's not. God spoke directly to Joseph's great-grandfather, to Joseph's grandfather, to Joseph's father. God never speaks to Joseph. And in fact, God speaks to very few people after that. You have some prophets, you have Moses, but as far as, like, the line of the family goes, like, this is where it starts to change. And the back and forth of being, like, the name that his mother gave him and the name that a messenger of God gave him, the fact that it's changing between the God name and the person name, I think is powerful. It's indicative of this other transition that's happening of Jacob as, you know, the son of Isaac, and Israel as the father of the Jewish people, right? And again, as I said earlier, like, Genesis is tying all the loose ends together of this book, but it's also setting up the next one. And Exodus is the story of a people. It's not the story of one family anymore, right? And, you know, that's Israel. That's the people. And the fact that it keeps going back and forth, it seems kind of appropriate for this moment in the narrative, because this is the pivotal moment. This is the transitional moment. Like, we're not quite, you know, it's all just about the family and we all have direct connection to God, but we're also not quite in the, it's not at all about the family and we're like a whole people now. We're in the part of the family tree that is just at the transition moment.
I think that has a parallel in Abraham, because Abram basically means exalted ancestor, ancestor to a family, basically. But Abraham means ancestor of a multitude. So in the same way that Abraham changed his name to be about all the people, Yaakov hasn't quite made that change to Yisrael, like the name of the people who wrestle with God.
Yeah, that's a beautiful interpretation, because again, thinking about this, about Genesis as like bookends, that's, you know, where the family tree starts, and now this story is like where the family tree is going to close. So yeah, I like that a lot.
Thanks.
Can we keep moving?
Yes.
So, and then his brothers throw him in a pit. His brothers see them coming, and they are mocking him. They're debating on whether to kill him. They talk about, they will tell their father that a wild animal has devoured him. And one brother speaks up for him and says, let's just throw him in the pit and pretend we killed him.
Real important to mention which brother. That really matters.
All right. And then Reuben stands before him.
All right. Reuben is the true Bechor. Reuben is the firstborn son. If anybody should want to kill this guy, it's Reuben.
Okay.
But Reuben, I think, is, and Jazz, you'll now hear me say this twice because this is what my Devarah Torah is going to be about. Reuben is the unsung hero and role model of this whole story, because this is a guy who could very well choose resentment and choose jealousy and choose pain because of the fact that his mother was treated so terribly by his father, because of the fact that he himself was treated so terribly by his father. But instead, he's the one that speaks up to save Joseph's life. And it is written there pretty explicitly, like, Reuben comes back for him. Reuben intends to bring Joseph home to Jacob. Like, Reuben is not just saying, let's have him languish in a pit. Reuben comes back, is not there when he is sold, sees the empty pit and goes, what am I supposed to do now, right? His whole plan was to save his brother's life. So, you know, we got to give Reuben a lot of credit here.
Yeah, it seems like he wasn't given the opportunity to be a trickster. So it's another way in which he's, like, not the main character of the narrative, despite his best efforts.
Yeah, but there is something about the named characters we get are really different than the unnamed characters we get, like the brothers as a mass versus any individual character of a brother. We get Reuben specifically speaking up for him when someone says, hey, let's kill him. We do not get a name for that person.
Which I think is a really good observation. And part of what makes that moment so powerful is it's like a mob mentality, group culpability thing. No one person said, let's do this, let's kill him. But they all agreed, except for Reuben, like, and later Judah, like, let's kill him, right? And this is a preview of next week's Parsha, but because it's like all kind of connected, you know, allow me to indulge for a second. Like, when Joseph meets his brothers later when they're in Egypt, the first inkling that Joseph gets that somebody tried to save him is when Reuben says to them, I told you not to do this. And he's saying this in Hebrew. They don't know that Joseph understands. They don't know who Joseph is yet.
Oh, right.
And it's when Joseph hears that, that his heart, like, melts and he has to excuse himself and he weeps. Because Joseph has no idea that any one of his brothers stood up for him, right? In Joseph's mind, all he sees is this mob.
Right.
Yeah. All of the brothers were against me. My whole family. For all he knows, his dad was against him. Mm-hmm. Right? Why'd he never write home? Hey, dad, I'm in charge of Egypt. Hope life is good. Like, you know, this dad who loved him so much, right?
Right.
How come he never wrote home?
Right.
It's because, you know, the last thing that dad told him was to go on this, like, suicide mission where the brothers mm-hmm. were waiting for him. And so Joseph goes on and thinks that, you know, you said, Lulav, when this parsha ends, it ends with somebody forgetting Joseph, mm-hmm. right?
Oh.
The chief baker forgets Joseph. And that is happening at a deeper level in Joseph's psyche because Joseph feels like he has been abandoned by his whole family, right?
Yeah.
And has no idea that anyone stood up for him. Another cool thing about Reuben in this moment, and this comes up in next one too, but you can even see it here, like the name Reuben, it's like see, right? Like the verb to see, mm-hmm. right? And when Leah had him, it was like, you know, God has seen my suffering, mm-hmm. right? The next son, what's his name? Shmuel?
Oh, we went through all of this, but yes. Yeah, they're all puns, yes.
Yeah, and that one is
like... Yeah, I'm trying to look it up right now.
It's hearing, right? Like, God has heard my cry. And what the brothers say to Joseph later, or to each other, is they're like, wow, like, you know, we saw his pain, but we didn't hear his cry, mm-hmm. right? Reuben told us, we listened to Reuben.
Right.
But the next up in line, we didn't listen. Mm-hmm. Even though we saw the suffering and Reuben told us, look what's happening. And we said, you know, we're looking at it. We didn't listen to Joseph crying. Mm-hmm. So anyway, yeah.
Do you think there is significance to the one selling him into slavery being Yehuda or this time I will praise the Lord?
Yeah, wait, that was my question on your summary. Lulav, please tell me more. How do you see Yehuda being the one that sells him into slavery? Where do you see that?
So... 37:26.
Uh-huh.
Then Yehuda said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers agreed.
Yeah, but read the next one.
When some Midianite traders passed by, they drew Yosef up, lifting him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they took Yosef to Egypt.
Okay. I agree with you that Judah suggested that he sell Joseph into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree with you that the brothers actually sold him into slavery.
Mm.
So if you look on 28, when it says that the traders came through and they pulled Joseph up, Vayimkeru et Yosef, it's a third person plural verb. They pulled Joseph up. Who's the they?
Me. Sorry, it's the brothers.
Okay. So the preface of this sentence is when the Midianite traders came through. So maybe it is... When the Midianite traders came through, the brothers pulled Joseph up, and then do the Midianites then sell him to the Ishmaelites? Because somebody ends up carrying him to Egypt, and it's not the Midianites.
Sure.
So
your argument is that the Midianites pull him out without the brothers being there?
Yes. My argument is that the brothers said that they were going to do this, and they agreed on it. And then before they actually did anything, Joseph is just in a pit somewhere. These Midianites walk past, and they say, oh, hey, look. A guy, let's take him. And so they pull him up and they sell him to the Ishmaelites.
This feels like when you're watching a murder show and they're like, I couldn't have murdered my husband. I was too busy buying poison so I could murder my husband later.
So look at the next line, right? When Reuben comes back to the pit, he's not there. He tore his clothes. He goes back to brothers. The boy's not there. What am I going to do? There is no moment where the brothers say, yeah, we sold him. Remember, we said we were going to do that.
Yes, but...
Okay, that's an interesting reading. I don't think I prefer that one, but it is, like...
What is the advantage of believing that his brothers didn't sell him?
Oh, because now it makes culpability so much more interesting, because...
They committed to it, right?
Right, they committed to it, but they didn't do it. But they're still guilty because they left him in a pit and didn't hear his cries, right? I think it's also interesting because then the brothers legit have no idea what happened to him.
Right.
Later in Egypt, right, when they get there and they're shocked to see their brother, if they had sold him to Egyptian slave traders, would they have been that shocked? Right?
I mean, they probably would have been shocked in the, like, why is he powerful now
that's
type
fair.
Of way.
But I read that, like, in a much more literal, like, they think their brother's dead. They have no idea what happened to him.
Mm.
Cool.
They don't expect to ever see him again. There's no body. There's no trace. Mm. He's just gone. And, like, that's a kind of guilt that you can't, you know, they would have felt guilty no matter what eventually. But I can't imagine what that kind of guilt is because you don't even know what happened to him.
Right? Yeah.
And you knew he would have been safe if you hadn't put him in that pit.
Right.
That's rough.
And his father definitely believes he is dead because they, even if they don't know what happened to him, they say, well, he's not there. I guess we have to tell our dad that he's dead. And so they cover his coat in an animal's blood and bring it to Jacob, who mourns for him.
All right, let's stay there for a second. You asked me what my argument is. 37:25. They sit down to eat. The brothers now. Joseph's in the pit screaming, but they're like, nah, we're gonna go have some lunch. So they go and they sit down to eat, and they see Ishmaelites. And Judah says, let's sell them to the Ishmaelites. But then look at the next verse. It says Midianite traders came through. These are not the same traders, the ones that Judah saw, right? And by the way, this is not my interpretation. This is Rashi's. I'm not taking credit for this.
Okay.
But, you know, they did, they saw people. And they said, maybe we can sell him to the Ishmaelites. But in the end, where do these Midianites come from? Why would that be there otherwise? I think that's there to make us ask this question of who really sold him. Otherwise, why would the Torah mention anything about the Midianites? It could just go straight from, they saw the Ishmaelites, they had an idea to sell him to the Ishmaelites, so they sold him to the Ishmaelites.
Okay.
It's true. I wonder also if there is a certain depth of, we know that the Torah relates really oddly to the other folks who are around them in terms of having created categories of people, like having created ancestry for the Midianites and the Ishmaelites to substantiate that these people are also related to them, right? Ishmaelites are also family.
Yeah.
And pretty closely related family.
Yeah.
Wait, isn't Midian one of the children of Ishmael?
My recollection actually is that the Midianites are children of Abraham's wife Keturah.
Okay.
And so they are also sort of the children of an unloved wife.
Which is so beautiful, right? There's such poetic justice to this family tree book ending with the descendants of the children of the unloved wives selling into slavery the favored child and the other brothers who are the children of the unloved wife being complicit. Whether they sold him or not, or whether they attended to or not, I guess we can agree to disagree. But I 100% agree with you that it is not an accident that we're talking about Midianites and Ishmaelites.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very familial story.
So then we get to Taruf Taraf with the coat. You gotta love this coat. This is Jacob, who deceived his own father with a coat once upon a time. And then he doesn't even see it when the same thing happens to him.
No, he is. He is incredibly distraught.
Guess I'll die, says Yaakov.
Right? Right. He doesn't, right? He lives for much, much longer.
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Yeah, but he is very convinced that Joseph is dead. And then we, like, smash cut over to Egypt, where Potiphar, who is, as far as we can tell, like, the equivalent of the police chief, buys him.
Now, I was telling Jazz before we started recording, there's a great word that happens in Hebrew in chapter 37, verse 36. Mm-hmm. It's when we hear that he is Saris Potiphar. So the word Saris...
I was just talking to our seventh graders about this, because it is... You didn't tell me the Hebrew one earlier. Saris is one of the things that the Talmud recognizes as its six sex categories.
Oh, yeah, well, that makes sense, right? Because the other way that you can translate the word Saris is that he was a eunuch.
So when the Talmud thinks of what are its six categories or gender or sex, they're very linked to how do we fit people into the community in relationship to do they marry and do they have children? And like what type of relationships do they have to these like normative societal models of family and like continuity? And Saris is a category of a person who seems like they would fit into the role of a man maybe, but also they can't have children.
Yeah, and that's got to make things real interesting for Potiphar's wife when he shows up one day with Joseph. And the first thing we learn about Joseph was that he's like a handsome-looking guy, like way earlier back in the, you know, he's 17 years old, you know, when the Parsha starts. So we got this, like, attractive teenage boy that is, like, now in your home, and you're Potiphar's wife, and, like, you haven't gotten what you wanted in a long time, because, like, your husband's a eunuch, and, like, your life sucks. Like, that's just... And then you go and you seduce Joseph. And I think that also changes, like, the tone of this story. Like, she wasn't just seducing him for the heck of it. She wasn't just this, like, lusty woman. It's like, you know, if he chose to be a eunuch, that's one thing. But what is that like for his partner?
That's a really generous interpretation. And also, seduce is a generous word to use.
Yeah.
And my instinctive read on it is more around the fact of, like, oh, she's married to the chief of police. They're a family that gets to exert a lot of power in the world. Maybe they are just a couple that is used to getting anything they want.
Yeah, and this smacks of the dynamic that led to a lot of, young black men getting lynched, which is that a white woman wants to be sexually fulfilled with a person she sees as not a whole person. And when he says no, she claims that he raped her. And then in this case, he gets thrown in prison. But in America, often it has been the case that, you know, the chief of police and the rest of the community just have a picnic while torturing people to death.
Right. That is sort of more, I would have said, my instinctive reading as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think really colored by the fact that her husband is so high up in the government and that she is so willing to, we should say, the thing that happens very specifically in this one is Potiphar's wife, whose name I don't think we ever get, honestly.
Why would we get her name? She's a woman.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, right, whose name we don't ever get, tries to sleep with Joseph. And when he refuses, she, like, leaves her jacket behind.
His jacket.
She has his jacket. And because he, like, wriggled out of her grasp, and she sort of claims she got it while fleeing as proof.
So, yeah, you're right. Maybe that is too generous an interpretation for me to be using the word seduce. And I hear you. And I'll go with that.
And I don't think that those are incompatible. The story that you told was from the point of view of Potiphar's wife. And the story that we immediately jumped on is from the point of view of Yosef.
Well, yeah. I would like to talk more about the point of view of Yosef, because I really like the first thing he says when this incident happens. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at chapter 39, verse 8. So the first thing Joseph says is like, look, my master gives no thought to what's in this house. All that he owns is put into my hands. There's none greater than I in this house. He's withheld nothing from me except for you, and as much as you're his wife. How then could I do this great evil and thus sin against God? You know, there's a reason that we call Joseph like tzaddik, right? Like a righteous one. And I think this is an example of that. Because this is not a good time in Joseph's life, right? He was stripped of his clothes by his brothers, put in a pit, sold into slavery. Now, if your interpretation is right, then even more so, he was just, like, sexually abused by this woman that, like, owns him or whatever. And the first thing he goes is, like, I don't want to sin against God. And there's, like, this relentless piety there that astounds me. Like, what would have to happen to this boy to be like, screw you, God, like, you messed up my whole life. How could you let this happen to me, right? Mm-hmm. Instead, his first response, like, as soon as this happens, is like, I'm not going to do this because I will not sin against God.
Does that square with you, with the 17-year-old we got earlier, who was like, oh, the world is going to bow down to me?
No, it doesn't. And I think it means that we're seeing Joseph start to grow, right? And I'm remembering what I said earlier, that, like, God never talks to Joseph directly. And so Joseph's moral growth here, yes, he's got dreams, but mostly he's got experiences and then what he chooses to do with that and, like, how he perceives that, right? And I think there's something that speaks to me here in a personal sense that I think all of us can learn from. That's like, when really awful things are happening in our lives, we can either choose to turn completely away from God and say, how could you let this happen to me? Or to turn closer to God and say, no, like, I'm going to try even harder not to miss the mark right now. Like, I want to do what's right. And Joseph, in this moment, this is a different Joseph. This is not the Joseph who's snitching on his brothers. This is not the Joseph who's talking about the dreams and how great he is. This is a Joseph who cannot be brought any lower, right? There is nothing lower than being sold into slavery. And in that moment, he makes a choice to recommit to the God of his fathers. And yeah. I think that's a really important, like, pivotal moment in the story.
And if I may, the version of that that feels appealing to me that doesn't quite depend so strongly on the God imagery of that, he's fine being, like, annoying and frustrating and, like, you know, when he feels like, oh, I'm doing great, this is sibling bickering. And sometimes when things get really hard, you get sort of more of a person's, like, character in some ways, right? Like, they either double down on being a bad person or decide to be a better person. Yeah. Not that I'm endorsing having hard things happen to people for that reason, but you know what I mean? That maybe there is some amount of, when he thinks he's just, like, bickering with his siblings, it is less of an incentive to really get his act together than when he's like, oh, actually, there's, like, real, real stakes.
Yeah.
So chapter 40, or I guess the end of 39.
It's also just worth mentioning here this thing about the garment that she holds on to.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the first time in Joseph's recent memory that he's been stripped of something he was wearing and it ended badly for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's death. Yeah.
And then what happens to him is also an echo, because he ends up in a dungeon that
he's thrown in a pit.
The Torah actually calls it a boar. It calls it a pit, right? And it's not a pit. They're calling it a pit because it's like really evoking for Joseph this same feeling. This is repeating exactly what happened before is happening again. Mm-hmm. But even in the pit, and this is stunning, but even when he's in the pit and he starts hearing these other dreams, that also for him is like, wait, this is also familiar. And it's like what happened to him before being sold is happening to him in reverse. You know, he's stripped of his clothes. He's thrown into a pit. There's something about dreams, but instead of him telling others, now others are telling him and he's interpreting it. And even in that moment where he's interpreting it, again, we hear something we didn't hear before, which is he says, it's not me, it's God.
Yeah.
Right? That's something that's different. We didn't hear him say, God's telling me these dreams that I'm going to be in charge. You're all going to bow down. We didn't hear that. We just heard, you know, these are my dreams.
Also, it's really interesting that at 48, he says, do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me.
Exactly.
And it's just like, oh, okay, I guess that's one of Hashem's domains, is interpretations of dreams.
Yeah.
Well, he knows that, I mean, his father had some crazy dreams with like the ladder and the angels, like, this is kind of in his blood, you know?
Right. But there was not an implication that only God can interpret dreams. Like, there was an implication humans could understand what was going on with dreams. Like, it is a new power to assume that, like, oh, this is godly stuff working through me.
Also, it's very funny to me that he's, like, the only worshiper of Hashem in, like, a 200-mile radius.
Yeah.
And so he's like, do not interpretations belong to God? And everybody else is like, What? Who?
Yeah, nobody reacts to that. There is no response to that. Nobody like chimes in to agree. Yeah.
The actual text, there is just no response.
There's just no response. They just are like, sure, okay, but
moving on.
You said tell them, so I guess we'll just say them now. Before we get to the dream interpretation, he gets thrown in prison. There is the thing with Potiphar's wife, and then he gets thrown in prison, and God blesses him in the sight of the prison warden. And the prison warden likes him and gives him power over the other people who are imprisoned there. And this is a thing that is resonating a lot with me at the moment.
Yeah.
I spent yesterday at a prison. I went to Rikers yesterday.
Oof.
Yeah. For those of our listeners who are not familiar, Rikers is a prison in New York. It is a very large prison. It is hopefully closing eventually. There are campaigns to close Rikers, and they are theoretically closing it and then replacing it with other smaller ones around the city. Anyway, I was there to lead a Nigun circle of like Jewish music for, you know, for Friday before Shabbat. And I'm thinking of what it means to say that God is with Joseph in a place as bleak as a prison, and that the way that blessing plays out is that the person in charge of keeping him incarcerated there, basically, is kind to him and also gives him more power over other unnamed people whose stories we do not get, who do not get lifted out of there, and he does not make life better for them, just gets power over them. The first power he gets in this story and the first people he gets power over are these unnamed other people who are incarcerated for unknown crimes.
So what's your specific feeling on that?
My specific feeling is that a Deco's framing of it would cast Joseph as a person who has grown in a way that is more ethical, and that this framing of the first power he is given is over other people in a really bad situation who he shows no connection with and who he never helps does not endear him to me.
See, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think our arguments are compatible. I didn't say Joseph became tzaddik right here. I said we call him tzaddik in our tradition. He's righteous. Mm. What I said is that he showed growth.
Mm.
And I'm really glad that you bring that up. And I didn't think about that, because this shows that even though he showed some growth, he wasn't done yet, right? And there's still like another lesson for him to learn, which I would argue he actually learns that lesson in the next parsha. And he learns that lesson when he ends up helping many strangers who are starving, including people that end up not being strangers, but being the people that put him into slavery, right? And it's like, and he stops, and he plateaued in his moral learning at this moment right here. He would have seen his brothers and been like, nah, no food for you. Go home.
So an interpretation that I have of the chief jailer paid no heed to anything that was in Joseph's care is, rather than that Joseph is immediately put into a position of power, the blessing of the Lord is that the people in charge of making sure you don't have a life don't take an active interest in giving you a bad time of it.
This is, you fly under the radar of the cops, not the cops make you one of them.
Yeah. And I don't think that it should be construed as like, if you're nice to the guards, they'll be nice to you. But that it should be construed as like, this is a boon.
Right. The blessing.
This is what the Lord provides an easier time of things in difficult times.
And just to point it out, this is not the first time in Egypt that Joseph is given power over other people. Because in the Potiphar story, he says to Potiphar's wife, your husband has given me control over all things in this house and has withheld nothing from me except for you, right? So I think this is like a pattern that he keeps being given an opportunity. He's given a lot of power, right? Mm-hmm. And what are you going to do with that power? And I don't think we really see him like use that power for good in this week's Parsha. I think we see that come to fruition in next week's Parsha when he meets his brothers and he chooses to forgive them.
Okay. Jazz, can you tell us about a cupbearer and a baker?
So while he's in prison, a cupbearer and a baker do something that angers Pharaoh, and they are also in prison. We don't know what they did. So, but they are near to where Joseph is, and they do say, like, the captain of the guard, who I think is still supposed to be Potiphar, assigned Joseph to them, so he helped them. He assisted with them, and so when they had prophetic dreams, they both dreamed the same night a similar dream. They tell those dreams to Joseph, who comes to them in the morning.
What's a cupbearer?
Is this a literal question? Because
this is a literal question. I do not understand what that person's role is.
Oh, okay. So a cupbearer just, like, brings cups to the king. So, like, if the pharaoh's thirsty and is like, hey, I'm thirsty, there's got to be somebody standing there to be like, oh, well, here's your cup.
So the specific type of nerd that I was as a child is that my primary association with the idea of a cupbearer is from Greek mythology, where Ganymede is a cupbearer to Zeus, and that, like, part of his job is, like, waiting on them and, like, bringing them, like, juices and things, and part of them is just, like, being a beautiful young man around the place that they can stare at.
Got it.
Yeah.
I think it's worthwhile that we learn that these two people have professions, and their professions are cupbearer and baker, one that has to do with thirst and one that has to do with hunger, because where we're going with this story is that Egypt is about to be cast into, like, a terrible famine, right? And it's cool that the guys that, like the dominoes that are, like, leading up to that for, like, all of this, like, to fall into place are guys whose job it is to make sure that one person, the person with all the power, doesn't go hungry or thirsty. And right. Then when Joseph gets some of that power, it's his job to make sure nobody does.
I like that. And I also like the, like, little working class solidarity happening here.
Yeah.
It's fun that he, like, made friends with both of these people.
So I really enjoy just the dreams here, where it's like, oh, in my dream, there was a vine and there were three branches and they budded and turned into grapes. And then I took the grapes and put them into Pharaoh's cup and placed it in his hand. And Yosef is like, oh, yeah, that sounds good. You're going to get out of here in 3 days. And then the baker is like, there were three cake baskets on my head and there were all sorts of baked food, but birds were eating it out of the basket. And Yosef is like, I think you're kind of screwed, my guy. In 3 days, you're going to get out of here and be hung.
Yeah.
So much for the solidarity.
Well, he only likes the cupbearer. Maybe it's only gay solidarity.
I also, like, I think those are fair interpretations of the dreams.
I do think those are fair interpretations of the dreams. It's very funny. It's very, you know, also very funny given how much, like, you know, I hang out around Jewish queers who are, like, into dream interpretation and witchy whatevers. And, like, that, you know, you get pushback on that in most Jewish circles. And it's just very funny. And dream interpretation is not a thing that, in modern times, that I have a lot of patience for, personally, because it feels very woo.
Oh, that's funny. See, I come from a long line of, like, clairvoyant dreams and all sorts of woo in my family. So I have a ton of respect. I'm all over this, like, 100%. I've had things explained to me in dreams that I didn't know in real life. And then in a dream, someone told me something was going to happen, and then it did. And lots of my family members have had that. I'm here for it.
I love it. The thing that I was actually saying wasn't meant to poke fun at the folks who were witchy or into dreams or any of that, actually. It was meant to be like, the Orthodox folks in my circles are like, this is not a Jewish thing. And I'm like, but it is a Jewish thing.
It is a Jewish thing.
It's right there.
My take on dream interpretation, by the way,
yeah,
is that, like tarot, it is best used as, like, therapy.
Yeah, I concur.
Like, figuring out what you are thinking and where you should go from there.
Yeah.
Finish us out, Jazz.
Okay. On the third day, it's Pharaoh's birthday, and he has a big feast, and he remembers about the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he brings the cupbearer back. And the cupbearer, like, places the cup back in Pharaoh's hands. And, yes, he kills the baker. And the cupbearer forgets about Joseph and moves on with his life.
You promised me, bro.
I really like how this is how this parsha ends. Because if you remember how it started, when it was like, this is the line of Jacob. It's the Joseph show. And now it's like the, nah, nobody remembers Joseph. His father forgot about him. His brothers forgot about him. Even the cupbearer forgot about him. And it's like, within this one parsha, his whole identity and life was turned upside down, which, again, speaks about his piety and how, you know, when eventually he is remembered and he comes back, he says it to Pharaoh later when he interprets Pharaoh's dreams. And he says, like, you know, this is through God, right? Like, he just, even though his whole world turned upside down from the beginning of his parsha to the end, somehow his faith actually gets strengthened the whole time. And to your point, Jazz, about the way that he's using his power, I think we could argue that his moral agency gets strengthened this whole time, too. And he learns how to stop being such a self-aggrandizing jerk and, like, more of, like, someone who uses his privilege and his power to help other people, including people who hurt him.
That's beautiful.
So before we close out the recording, let's each ask a personal question of Deco, just for funsies.
Great. Shoot.
So Deco, you mentioned a bagel party for your bi mitzvah.
Yeah.
What's your favorite kind of bagel?
What word are you saying right now?
Bagel.
What is a bagel? I'm a New Yorker. How are you
pronouncing it?
Bagel with like a long A. Bagel. I don't know what a bagel is.
Listen, we're saying the same word and you know it.
No, you're saying some sort of foreign thing. I don't understand.
Midwest? More like mid-best.
Let's not get into this. Okay, so my favorite kind of bagel, Lulav, is a rye. No, that's a lie. Okay. He's a pumpernickel. That's it. Pumpernickel.
Pumpernickel.
Yeah.
That's my favorite.
Am I asking a question here?
If you want.
I ask Deco lots of questions. I see Deco most days. Is this your favorite Torah portion? And if not, do you have a more favorite one?
No, this is my favorite.
Aww.
That's why I picked it. Yeah.
It's so lovely.
Also, my little brother's name is Joseph, so.
Aww.
I mean, I have two other siblings too, but they don't have a Torah character named after them, so, but yeah, that's my favorite one.
We have a couple quick things before we wrap up for this real long episode.
Oh, wait, sorry, we never rated the Parsha?
That's what I was gonna say. That's okay. One of our last things is we have to do our ratings for the week. Can we do this in a circle?
Mm-hmm. Who am I doing it to?
You can ask Deco.
Okay.
Who you'll ask me in all
of Lula. Deco, if you had a coat of many colors and the coat was this Parsha, how many colors would it have?
Okay, when you said this was going to be a rating, I was not expecting this. All right, got it. So I would say it would have 12.
Okay.
Aww.
Nice. That's a lot of colors.
That is a lot of colors. You gave them an open-ended scale?
Yeah.
All right.
Ever since you introduced open-ended scales, I have loved...
That feels like a mean way to do it for someone's first rating.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. It's cool. It's great. Now I have to ask you a question?
No, I can do Lulav next, and you can ask me. I will not give Lulav an open-ended scale.
Okay.
Lulav, out of... Oh, this isn't the right one. Out of 4 dreams with real-life consequences, how many dreams would you give this Parsha?
Okay. I would give this Parsha 3 dreams out of 4.
How come?
I didn't like the one with the wheat, and if we're talking about DreamWorks movies, this one had worse animation than The Prince of Egypt.
Great.
But yeah, like, generally speaking, there's an interlude that involves some nasty stuff. It's good storytelling all around, and Deco's insights definitely helped a lot with me appreciating this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I relate a lot to the brothers.
Great. Thank you.
So now I have to ask you a question,
mm-hmm.
which we're loosely calling a rating.
It is a rating.
Okay. So on a scale of firstborn child to hated wife. How do you feel about the plot development in this Torah portion?
Ooh. Okay. I would rate this Torah portion as being the overlooked but still virtuous firstborn because I liked it. I thought there was some really, really interesting things happening in it. And there's, like, interesting things that I still want to think on more deeply in terms of how some of it could feel applicable to thinking about how we act in the world in terms of how we act under pressure or in bad circumstances or what we think about prison or what we think about siblinghood and what it means to be a sibling. And I don't love everything that happens in it, but I do really think that it does, when you say specifically plot development, from the beginning to the end, there's a real narrative coherency and flow. Like we were talking about in some of our earlier chapters, like no new people just suddenly pop up. I understand where everybody's coming from. And also, I do feel like we get more context on, like, the world and the people and why people are making the decisions they're making. And it does feel like there are a lot of decisions not just happening, but people having to interact with each other.
Good answer.
Thank you.
So, just to clarify, the ratings for this week
were
12 colors for a coat, 3 out of 4 dreams with real-life consequences, and Reuven out of Binyamin children.
Yeah, kind of.
Or wait, no, you said that is two hated wife. So Reuven out of Leah.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. All right, let me go to the outro. Thank you for listening to Kosher Queers this week with our bonus guest. Woo. If you like what you've heard, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/kosherqueers, which will give you bonus content and help us keep making this for you. Also, I think this week we have a bonus content for the bit we skipped in the middle of the parsha, so that should be fun. You can also follow us on Twitter at Kosher Queers, or like us on Facebook at Kosher Queers, or email us your questions, comments, and concerns at kosherqueers@gmail.com. Our artwork, as always, is by the talented Lior Gross. Our music is courtesy of the fabulous band Brivola, whose work you can find on Bandcamp. Go buy their album, they're great. And our sound production is done by my lovely co-host, Lulav Arnau.
Oh, I fell in a pit.
It's going to do terrible things to our audio.
Dika, where can we find you on the internet?
You can find me at Facebook. What am I? I think I'm KM Dekalandria at Facebook.
Yeah.
I'm also on Instagram. Listen, I talk like a 34-year-old, Jazz. Stop laughing at me. I don't understand your language. I'm trying my best. I am Instagram at Deko_NYC.
Oh, yeah, accept my Instagram request.
I did not have my phone for last week, and you know this.
That's right. Yes, I forgot. I'm Jazz Twersky, and you can find me at WordNerdKnitter on Twitter. Deko and I recorded our audio on the traditional lands of the Lenape people.
I'm Lulav Arnau, and you can find me at SpaceTruck6 on Twitter, or yell at me at PalmLiker. I recorded this audio on the traditional lands of the Wapekute and Anishinaabeg. Have a lovely queer Jewish day.
This week's gender is tired.
This week's pronouns are